Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture here in Seattle, Washington. We have in our studio with us today a guest that many ID the Future listeners have heard before, a real bona fide living, breathing brain surgeon, Dr. Michael Egnor, professor of neurosurgery at State University New York Stony Brook, who also has a thriving medical practice where he will actually do surgery on your brain. But Dr. Egnor is actually a very well-known proponent of intelligent design. He was in the documentary Expelled. He blogs for our Evolution News and Views website, where he regularly keeps updates on the issue of intelligent design versus evolution, sparring with many well-known Darwinists such as P.Z. Myers and others out there on the internet. And he's also just a wonderful gentleman and a very wonderful scholar. So Dr. Egnor, thank you so much for being here on the show with us today.
Thank you, Casey.
So Dr. Egnor, I'd first like to talk about an area that I think you are very well qualified to speak in, and that is the area of mind-brain interaction and what implications that has for the debate over intelligent design. So tell us first, what is your view of mind-brain interaction, and are the mind and the brain one and the same? And if they're not the same, what are the implications for intelligent design?
The nature of the relationship between the mind and the brain has really been probably the most active area of modern philosophy, certainly over the past century. And these questions date back thousands of years. Over the past half century or so, materialists have played an important role in this debate, and there have been many efforts to describe the mind in a purely material fashion, to simply say that the mind is the brain, or that rather the mind is what the brain does. And it's becoming, I think, clear to a number of philosophers that the materialistic explanations fall very, very short of explaining the mind. And there's pretty good reason to think that materialism alone can never explain the mind.
Mm. So the implication is that if the mind is just sort of an epiphenomenon of the brain, and all we really are, our consciousness is just sort of a software running on a meat computer, would that sort of be the way to describe the materialist position? Is that?
Yes. The materialists have a number of different positions. Each position is nuanced to attempt to explain one of the materialist problems. But the materialist understanding of the mind is sort of one big problem, and they really haven't been able to get past them. For example, you mentioned that the mind may be an epiphenomenon of brain activity. There is a materialist theory called epiphenomenalism
that
actually theorizes that, in fact, the mind is an epiphenomenon. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that the mind is generated by brain activity, but has no influence on the brain. That is that, for example, if you decide you want to get a cup of coffee, there are neurotransmitters and action potentials in your brain that make your body go get the cup of coffee. Your thought that you want to get the coffee is kind of a byproduct of what your brain is doing, but your thought that you want to get the cup of coffee itself has no influence on your brain. It's the brain doing it.
Okay.
And the problem with epiphenomenalism, which is really has at least until the past decade or two been a very widely held view, the problem with epiphenomenalism is that if your mind can have no influence on your brain, then you can't talk about your mind. Because the mind can have no influence. You're talking about something that can't influence your brain. So that even discussion of the mind presumes the falsehood of epiphenomenalism.
Very interesting. So one way to refute that argument would be to show that the mind can have an effect, a physical effect on the brain. Is that correct?
It must, because the mind must have a physical effect if you can talk about the mind.
Okay,
because
okay.
If you can't talk about, because if the mind has no effect on the brain, then no one can make an argument about the mind that has any bearing on reality.
Okay.
So that the very fact that you're discussing the mind means that epiphenomenalism is false.
Okay. Well, aside from the fact that we can talk about the mind and talk about the brain, are you aware of scientific research? And I think we may be getting into this with future podcasts with Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, who's also here with us today. But what is some research evidence that you're aware of that shows that the mind can have a physical effect on the brain?
Well, the evidence is overwhelming. The evidence, I mean, that the mind has a physical effect on the brain all the time in everyday life. If you think certain thoughts, things happen in your brain. Mm-hmm. Exactly how this effect takes place is a very, very difficult question. And it's a difficult question not only for materialists, it's a difficult question for dualists, the interaction phenomenon. But that difficulty is for all of us. It's not simply for the dualists.
So what, in your perspective, is the relationship between the mind and the brain?
I believe that the best theory, the best paradigm for understanding the relationship between the mind and the brain is a very old theory called hylomorphism. And it was a theory that was advanced by Plato and Aristotle that views the mind or the soul as the form of the body, including the brain. And that that a human person is a combination of matter and form. And this has been the belief, for example, of Thomas Aquinas, great scholastic philosopher. And there's a real resurgence of hylomorphism, that the mind is not separable from the brain, but that the mind is the form of the brain and can only be understood in that way.
Hmm. So what are the implications for many different fields, such as law or bioethics, if the mind is nothing more than a piece of software running on a meat computer? Basically, our mind is not generating the thoughts to go get the cup of coffee. It's the brain that is somehow firing nerve impulses that make your body go get the coffee, and you aren't even, basically, we're just puppets on the string, and we're puppets controlled by our brains. What are the implications of that view for fields outside of science, such as, I said, law and bioethics and that sort of thing?
Well, it really goes to the question of what are the implications for materialism.
Okay.
Taken broadly, is understanding human beings, understanding man, as purely a materialistic entity. And of course, the consequences of materialism, I think, have already been catastrophic in the 20th century. The greatest materialistic ideology of the 20th century was communism, which certainly didn't respect the rights of man. And if one takes away all notion of purpose and teleology in human life, one is left, I believe, simply with assertions of power, which is sort of what Nietzsche said.
Mm. Yes, the will to power.
And the will to power is sort of the description of the 20th century, and I fear it may be continuing with some force.
Okay, very interesting. Well, I know, Dr. Eggener, that you are a fan of Wesley J. Smith, who is a bioethicist who looks a lot at human dignity and the implications of these kind of issues for whether humans should, basically be treated like animals and that sort of thing in various circumstances. What are the implications of the debate over the relationship between the mind and the brain for those kinds of questions, for human dignity and some of those bioethical questions?
Well, the first issue, and it sounds a bit esoteric, a bit philosophical, but I think it is of fundamental importance. And that is that if you assume that a human person is strictly a material entity, you remove all notions of inherent worth, intentionality, which is a philosophical term meaning attributing desires and beliefs, and a human being simply becomes an animal, and an animal who can be bred for the purposes of the people who are in power. And that's what eugenics was, and eugenics is still very much with us, and it's the notion that human beings can be bettered through purely materialistic methods was a catastrophic idea in the 20th century. So understanding that there is a component of human beings that is not simply material, I think, is the foundation for any kind of respect for human dignity.
Wow. You mentioned intentionality, and I think we've talked about this a couple times in other podcasts here, but when I was in criminal law in law school, obviously one of the main elements of many crimes is what was the intent of the actor, what was in their mind, what was going on in their heads. And the implication there, the assumption there, is that we have free will, and is that we have the ability to choose between right or wrong, left or right, to kill or not to kill, and all these different choices that we're able to make. If the brain is simply pulling the strings of the mind, do we really have the ability to choose our actions?
Sure, and that particular question has been debated fiercely amongst philosophers. I think it's extremely difficult to make a coherent case that you have free will if you're simply matter, that is, that matter is governed by the laws of physics, and free will plays no role in the laws of physics that we know of. There is no Newton's law of free will. So if the human mind is the human brain, and the human brain is simply a physical object, it's very difficult to ascribe either credit or blame for a human action. And again, what I think happens is, when you take away those concepts, what ultimately happens is that power is what determines things. That is, that if you can do it and get away with it, then it's okay. So it really tears down our system of ethics and morality to understand human beings as material objects.
And, of course, one of the ways where this issue plays out in history is the famous case where the famous attorney, Clarence Darrow, who, of course, defended John T. Scopes in the Scopes trial, he was the famous Darwinist attorney, defended two gentlemen named Leopold and Loeb, who allegedly committed murder. And my understanding of the case is that basically he argued that they were not in control of their actions, that from sort of a Darwinian materialist perspective, whether it was their genes and or the environment, that's what made them commit the murder. It wasn't choice. They didn't actually rationally choose to commit a crime. And there was no argument here that they were insane or that they were under some kind of influence. It was literally they were in their right minds, but still they should not be held guilty for what they had done. So don't blame these poor guys. Is that your understanding of that case?
Yes, it is. And it cuts both ways. That is, that a materialistic Darwinian understanding of human origins not only can, in a sense, exonerate people who through their own will, harm other people in grievous ways, but it can also permit the abuse of completely innocent people. That is, that for example, the sterilization of people during the time of eugenics in the early 20th century, and there were probably about 60,000 Americans, completely innocent people, who were sterilized against their will because it was viewed by the people in power, by the government authorities, that it was better that their family line not continue for various, you know, judgmental reasons. So if you believe that a human being is pure matter and that there's no other component to people, you can exonerate horrendous behavior in a deterministic way, but you can also do terrible things to innocent people for those reasons.
Would you say that the whole idea that we should rehabilitate prisoners and try to encourage them to make better choices is based upon, or at least most strongly supported by, a non-materialist account of the mind, where if human beings make certain choices and they've made bad ones, we can treat them as rational beings that make choices and try to encourage them to make better choices in the future that won't get them into trouble? I mean, is that sort of a perspective to dealing with criminals and prisoners? Right. Is that most strongly justified by a materialist perspective or a non-materialist perspective?
Well, certainly the notion that human beings have intrinsic worth and that measures should be taken to help them even if they've done horrible things is an ancient notion that's very very closely correlated with non-materialistic beliefs, religious beliefs, and so on. And that's a Christian belief, a Jewish belief, an Islamic belief, that goes back a long ways. There's no question that if one looks, for example, at the 20th century, where materialistic ideology actually had the reins of power, and they had the reins of power in a third of the world, that respect for human beings and efforts to humanely rehabilitate people who had actually committed crimes was in great short supply. Some of the greatest atrocities that mankind has ever known have been committed by people who were ideologically committed to the notion that human beings were strictly material entities.
Well, Dr. Egnor, it's really wonderful to talk to you about this. I think that we're going to do some more interviews with you and talk about some more topics. So stay tuned for more interviews with Dr. Michael Egnor. Thanks for being on the show with us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.